Thank you very much for coming. It's good to be back with the Geneva Press Corps, and I'd like to briefly talk about three things. One, the annual meeting of the Executive Committee of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which we're attending this week. The recent visit which some donors, some of the principal donors made with the High Commissioner for Refugees and his team to Chad and to Darfur. And then a finally just a brief note on the U.S. resettlement program for refugees, what our record has been after the difficulties of 9/11 and the difficulties of people not fleeing oppression as much as they did during the Cold War. First of all, with respect to the annual meeting of the High Commissioner for Refugees, our interest in that meeting, as always, is to demonstrate U.S. leadership in support of the multilateral system. No country can compare to our multilateralism when it comes to working on behalf of refugees through the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. No other country touches the Agency for International Development either, as Mr. Garvelink will mention in a few minutes, with respect to the contribution of food to the UN World Food Program. We're also talking about the need for protection and for food security for refugees. This is a particularly difficult year coming up where, for several reasons, we expect an approximate $1 billion shortfall in emergency food, which will include refugee food requirements. Now, this is a very serious situation, both for refugees that that don't have any other means of support, that are really the poorest of the poor and the most vulnerable, and also the food shortage, which will be coming up at the end of this year and into 2005, can jeopardize refugee solutions in places such as Liberia, other places in Africa where refugees are returning, and in Afghanistan, where we have the largest return in modern history. So these are the some of the concerns that we have about security. Also, we're taking note, not to forget, the return of refugees from Pakistan and Iran to Afghanistan. We will not forget Afghanistan. This is the biggest refugee success story of modern times. 3.6 million refugees have returned from Iran and Pakistan to Afghanistan. And this is a tremendous effort to make that irreversible, that is, to provide the employment and the basic necessities of life so that they can pick up their lives again in Afghanistan. So far that's succeeded, but it's an effort that we have to continue to work on and support and to keep the other donors focused on this requirement. This is another purpose of this executive committee, to remind the donors of the need for financial burden sharing. The United States is a reliable donor to the High Commissioner for Refugees programs around the world. An average of 25% of all those programs, the costs of those programs, are provided by the United States. In Africa, we do more because some of the donors are less generous. In Africa, the United States does 30%, and sometimes we do more than 30%. But we try to keep that level of proportion advertised and clear and transparent to everybody so that the UNHCR can count on it and the other donors can count on it, and that means that they have to provide the other 70% or 75% of the costs. We'll have to come to a similar proportion for food because of the real dramatic crisis with respect to the increasing food needs as related to the decreasing of availability of food to meet those needs around the world. So burden sharing is another important part of the meeting of the High Commissioner at this annual meeting of the Executive Committee. Now, with respect to the recent visit, which four donor countries, the United States and Japan, Germany, and the European Community made with the High Commissioner for Refugees to Chad, and then to Darfur, and on to Khartoum in Sudan. The situation in Chad is not yet satisfactory. Very difficult conditions. The staff of UNHCR and the NGOs did a tremendous effort in the early days of the emergency to get the Darfurian refugees off the border and into areas where they could be assisted and where food could be stockpiled before the start of the rainy season. During the rainy season, it was very difficult. It was a Herculean logistics task. I can't say that we've turned the corner yet in Chad. There are tremendous needs of the local population. There are tensions with the local population in the area where refugees are being provided assistance in Chad. And so the international community is faced with the need to minimize those tensions and to provide a fair share proportion of their assistance to the local Chadians who initially gave so much of their own food and non-food items to the refugees to help them survive in those difficult early days. The threat that we see in Chad is the possibility that more refugees could come over from Sudan, from Darfur. Our estimate is that as many as 100,000 could be making up their minds as to whether conditions are so bad in Darfur that they would need to protect themselves and their families by coming across the border into Chad. And so we're encouraging the High Commissioner for Refugees and the NGOs to do the contingency planning that would be needed to accommodate another up to 100,000 refugees in Chad. This would be a huge burden. Now, the role of the UNHCR, as we saw it clearly in Darfur, is to have mobile patrols along the border between Darfur and Chad to give some confidence and assurance to the internally displaced persons who've been displaced by the by the efforts of the Janjaweed, in some cases in conjunction with the Sudanese government, committing the genocide which has occurred and tragically is still occurring in parts of Darfur. The need for the High Commissioner for Refugees to have protection officers mobile, able to be the voice and the eyes and ears for the local population that are totally distrustful of their own government to protect them. So they have no place to go. Excuse me. When their women are raped and they go to the government to have the matter investigated, the government refuses to open an investigation file. And so the internally displaced persons who have been subject to so much persecution and so much tragedy really need these mobile teams of the High Commissioner for Refugees in order to go and report their grievances and the incidents that have been committed against them. Someday we hope that the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Bill Garbalink will mention the support from AID to the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Someday we hope that Louise Arbour will have a large number of mobile human rights teams to be the voice for the voiceless, internally displaced person. But that will take a while to recruit and to train and to deploy the hundreds of people that it will take to provide that role. So this is why it's so important for the High Commissioner for Refugees to play this interim protection role in Darfur. We had very frank discussions with the government of Sudan. We made it clear to them that we saw total distrust on the part of the IDPs with their government to protect them, that they depended on the international community, and it was vitally important for the government of Sudan to permit the international community to come in and play that protective role for the people who felt that they had no other protection. The African Union has its monitors that are starting to get in place to monitor the ceasefire, but they need a lot of support from the international community, and they need a lot of increase in their own staff and equipment in order to fulfill that responsibility of monitoring. So a lot rests on the international community to fill this confidence gap. There's a huge confidence gap that exists in Darfur today. Finally, the United States supports principally the refugee solution of return to their homes. The U.S. effort in Afghanistan was instrumental in effect liberating an entire society so that refugees in huge numbers, in the millions, could feel free to come back to their homes. So that's the primary effort of the United States working through the Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees. But there are some people who can't go back home. They've been through so much trauma that the only future for them is to be resettled in a third country, to a European country, or to Canada, or Australia, or to the United States. The United States settles more than 50% of all people in that category that are referred to the international community by the High Commissioner of Refugees. This year, we have just finished our fiscal year on the 30th of September, and we were able to resettle in the United States 52,875 refugees. This has been a difficult effort. I have spent a lot of my time on it because we've had to deal with a far different situation than we had during and just after the Cold War, when refugees were fleeing communism. And they came from two principal locations. They came from Southeast Asia, where we had hundreds of thousands, and they came from the former Soviet Union, where there were tens of thousands wanting to get out and come to other countries. Now we have 46 locations. Some of those locations are dangerous. We have to move whole refugee camps so our Department of Homeland Security interviewers can reach them and interview them. And we have huge costs associated with transportation and protection for the refugees in these dangerous locations. We have refugees now representing 60 different nationalities that come to the United States. So this has been a good result for the United States, but I think a better result for refugees who have no other hope, no other future, no other rescue than to come to the United States. I'll turn it over now to Bill Garvelink, and then after he has finished, we'll welcome your questions.
Thanks. I'd like to talk just a couple of minutes about what the U.S. government has been doing in Darfur. The crisis in Darfur has been a priority for the United States government for more than a year now. The fighting began in 2003, and in April of that year, the next month, the fighting began in March, and in April, we had our first assessment teams into Darfur, and by May and June, the assistance began to arrive. So that's been well over a year and a half ago for our beginning involvement in Darfur. The U.S. has pledged $299 million for assistance to Darfur in 2004 and 2005. We have already obligated $257 million for Darfur. 194 of that has gone to Darfur. This is the larger crisis, and $62 million has gone to Chad. Of that total of $257 million, $187 million of that total has gone to United Nations agencies. Today, we provided $600,000 to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to increase humanitarian monitoring teams in Darfur from 8 to 16. The High Commissioner for Human Rights and her monitoring teams in Darfur are an indispensable instrument for holding the government of Sudan and all armed groups accountable for stopping the widespread violence against civilians in Darfur. Unfortunately, the crisis in Darfur continues, and the number of IDPs increases every day. UN agencies and NGOs are active in Darfur. Their work, however, has been hampered by insecurity and continued violence in Darfur. And because of that, there have been assistance gaps still in food, water, sanitation, shelter, and in health care. Mortality and global acute malnutrition rates exceed emergency levels. And this year, the harvest in Darfur will be approximately 20% of normal. In short, the crisis in Darfur has not yet peaked, and we have not yet seen the worst in Darfur.
Go ahead.
Abdelnaby, Kuwait News Agency. I have two questions. The first is to Mr. Dewey. I'd like to ask the four donors, as a result of that mission, do they have new pledges and commitments to Darfur and Chad? My second question is to you, sir, about the worst has not yet come. What could we hear worse more than what we're hearing since the crisis started?
The first question was, as a result of the donor mission to Chad and Darfur with the High Commissioner for Refugees, were there specific pledges of new support? Four donors, just to remind you, were the United States, Japan, Germany, and the European Union. Japan did mention some specific increases that they do plan to give for both Chad and Darfur, and I think this visit helped to confirm that that was the right thing to do for Japan. They wanted to see it firsthand, and then I'm sure that they will announce soon additional contributions to those two crises. Now, with respect to Germany, we didn't have indications of any new contributions or from the European Commission, but in our daily contacts, we were able to discuss the fact that we had to have better burden sharing. There had to be a lot more support from other donor states, and that the United States could not continue to bear 80% of the effort in Darfur and approaching 50% in Chad. That's unsustainable. So in that respect, the visit was useful. We have to keep after the other donors to make sure that they come through with some specific contributions as a result.
All right, couple of comments. We USAID did a projection this past April of what would happen in Darfur if access to IDP settlements was not full and open by the Sudan government. And we projected based on historical trends. We did studies of Darfur earlier, southern Sudan, Ethiopia, and some other places in East Africa, and suggested that between 80,000 and 300,000 people would die between April and the end of this year, December. And if the international humanitarian community had greater access, that number would be lower. And if the access was restricted, that number would be higher toward the number of 300,000. We're finding that what the reports we're getting from NGOs and UN agencies are that number is starting to increase. You can look at this in phases. In April and May, people were dislocated because of fighting. They moved away from their villages that were destroyed into camps and settlements. In the middle of the summer, these folks were not receiving regular food rations or health care because of security reasons. NGOs and the World Food Program could only get to them periodically because of security. So the women in particular and children under five were seriously weakened during the summer. Now the rains have happened and these people, again, still are not getting sustained assistance. It comes in sporadic, it's sporadic. And the recent studies by MSF France, WHO, the World Food Program are suggesting that mortality rates are starting to climb. What we're starting to see now, and the harvest will be coming in, so you'll see a little bit of food in the market, but not much, with a 20% below normal production. The fodder for cattle will last maybe a month or so, too. And so we have several hundred thousand people, more or a million seven people, who are severely malnourished, who have been through a very rough time in the past year. Food will run out from the harvest before the end of the year because it's so little, and we're going to see, you might want to call it a tipping point in December, January, February, where the mortality rates are going to go up very high, and it will be very hard for the international community to do anything to reduce those mortality rates in the short term. And these are our projections, but they're being confirmed by UN agencies and NGOs. So I think that an increase in mortality rates we're going to notice as the year comes to an end. It'll be much higher than it is now.
Gordon Martin, Vatican Radio. Mr. Dewey, sir, you said that you had had frank talks with the government in Khartoum. But seen from this distance, the government in Khartoum doesn't seem to be taking still much notice of pressure being put on it to rein in the Janjaweed and that sort of thing. Is the United States government working to increase pressure on the Khartoum government? Thank you.
The Secretary of State has repeatedly placed this pressure on the government of Khartoum, and not only done that, but he's visited Sudan and has had a chance to see some of the suffering firsthand. He keeps up that pressure and those contacts because we haven't seen the sufficient response from the government of Sudan. We still see that total distrust on the part of the IDPs with respect to their government. So it is very frustrating that the government of Sudan publicly doesn't acknowledge the horror of what has happened, and tends to dismiss it as an aberration which is partially implemented independently by a disparate group of Janjaweed tribesmen, and refusing to admit what is obvious to every serious observer, that these have been combined operations with the government of Sudan, with Janjaweed tribes people. So it continues. The interest of the United States in Sudan is fundamentally a vital interest, but it's a humanitarian vital interest. That's the message. And so we're not going to rest until we have been able to get sufficient humanitarian presence and assets to fill the humanitarian space, which has increased significantly from what it was just 6 weeks ago. So we have to fill that space with sufficient NGOs and with sufficient international organization presence to compensate for the fact that we're not getting sufficient support from the government of Sudan.
We just follow up quickly, sir. Isn't that, with all respect, rather putting the cart before the horse? I mean, you're curing, with admirable efforts, the humanitarian disaster, but little seems to be done still to, as I say, to put the pressure on the perpetrators, who, are, after all, are the Khartoum government.
That is our dilemma. What will get the attention of the perpetrators? I think that the contribution which USAID announced today to the High Commissioner for Human Rights is going to be an interesting test as to whether a significant deployment of UN human rights monitors will be permitted by the Sudanese government. It has to go in stages. That pressure has to be focused on getting the Sudanese government to permit not only UNHCR protection monitors on the border, but also I don't know how many hundred UN human rights monitors with great mobility are needed in Darfur. That's going to be an important test. The international community has got to be unified on that. We can't see these divisions over, well, it may be genocide, it may not be genocide, we don't have enough proof on genocide. We've got to have the humanitarian international community united to say we have to have this international UN confidence-building voice for the IDPs who are now voiceless and don't have the protection from the government.
Mr. Dewey, I have two simple questions, because I'm very curious. My first, as you are dealing with the refugees' problems in Sudan, you have a priority for the refugees, Darfur refugees. In Cairo 3 weeks ago, the Sudanese refugees in Egypt attacked the UN office in Cairo because they don't receive their financial support, which is fixed by the UNHCR. It is not a priority for the USA to help these Sudanese refugees in Egypt, number one. Number two, as you speak about the refugees in Afghanistan and some other parts of the world that they receive your aid, what about the Iraqi refugees? Because it's a huge number, too. Thank you.
With respect to the Sudanese refugees in Cairo, we will have taken into the United States from Cairo over 3,000 refugees to be resettled in the United States. These are Sudanese refugees that we don't think will be able to go back to Sudan, even with the peace settlement. And so I think we're doing our part. We're doing more than any other country in the world to resettle this very needy group which still exists in Cairo. The High Commissioner for Refugees has taken a position after the Naivasha peace talks that the situation would change for Sudanese refugees and that the UNHCR could be planning on returns. We'll have to see if the situation, if the peace talks result in an implementation of peace so that you have real peace, so that refugees from Cairo and probably a total of 500,000 Sudanese refugees from countries around the Sudan will be able to return. And I assure you, when that is possible, that the United States will bear its share of the burden and the high cost of bringing them back to Sudan and permitting. So I don't think there's any discrimination against Sudanese refugees in Cairo or anywhere else around the region. The United States is going to be there toward that solution. Your second question was the priorities for the United States with respect to Iraqi refugees. This is a big concern of mine because we have approved for at least the Department of Homeland Security had approved Iraqi refugees for admission to the United States from Beirut and from other countries in the region. We have kept putting pressure on the Department of Homeland Security to tell us, is it possible for those people to come into the United States? Do you have anything that would indicate that they are a security risk? If you don't, let's admit them to the United States. Those talks continue between my bureau in the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security to settle this problem once and for all. Say, well, you can't come in because we have these specific problems, or yes, we will admit to the United States. It's been frustrating. We'll continue to work on it.
Lisa Schlein, Voice of America. A couple of questions. First to Mr. Garvelink. Numbers always, I drown in them. And the reporting seems to have stabilized at about 50,000 killed since February, I believe. Then the World Health Organization has come out with predictions of or estimates of between 6 to 8, 10,000 people dying from hunger, disease, all this sort of thing in the camps. And now you came up with a figure of 80,000 to 300,000, which is a little bit higher than what we've been talking about. How do you reconcile all this? And I mean, is 50,000 the accurate number? Have we gone beyond that? How far can we go help?
I'll give it a whirl. First of all, in all honesty, the numbers of 50,000 or 30,000 killed is somebody's guess. Most of that number usually refers to those killed in conflict, and I have no idea if that's true or not. Our number, which, yeah, this isn't too helpful, I know. The numbers we use, we put together in April, and I don't have any with me, but we have a graph that will show mortality rates. And it's based on some epidemiologists from the Centers for Disease Control and some epidemiologists from USAID who went back and historically looked at the conditions in Darfur in terms of population, in terms of security, in terms of how long the rains would last, and the geographic conditions. And we said from April to the end of this year, if there is no access to those IDP settlements, you'll have over 300,000 people die. If there's full and open access, there'll be only about 80,000 people will die as a result of what's going on in Darfur right now, on the humanitarian side of things, not the conflict side, not war wounds. What we have seen from all the reports that are coming out by the various NGOs and UN agencies is that we're coming to the high side of that range of numbers. I would say we're probably in the 200,000 to 300,000 range by the end of the year. Now, what we're seeing is because the rains were not good, because the harvest was very bad, we're going to see in a month a little bit of a blip. There's going to be more food in the market. Livestock are going to have food to eat for a very short period of time, and then that very small harvest will end, and the people who are weakened by months of living in an IDP camp will start to die, particularly women and children, and they'll die at a much higher rate than they are now. Just a comment that Gene Dewey made the point, I think, earlier, and it's an important one, but it slips by a lot. Of all the IDP populations I've seen anywhere, this is the one that is the most restricted to its settlements. They can't go out and forage for food. They can't look for firewood. They can't look for water. If they do, the men are killed and the women are raped. So these populations are totally dependent on support by the international community. Now, if there's security problems, WFP can't get food to them. UNICEF can't get water and sanitation in there on a consistent basis. The NGOs can't provide health care. So this IDP population is in a more weakened state than any other IDP population in similar circumstances would be. The harvest didn't come in. It's going to get very bad between now, the end of the year, and the first couple months of next year. That doesn't help a whole lot with your numbers, but I think hard numbers are very hard to come by because of the conflict. We really don't know what the IDP situation is in rebel areas. We're getting into there more often. We're doing assessments, but we really don't know. So I feel very uncomfortable when people get the specific numbers because nobody really knows. So that's why we did a range, and I think unfortunately, the situation in Darfur is going to put us toward that high end of the range at the end of the year.
Follow up?
Yeah. I've got a question with reference to the estimates by the assistant administrator. In the event where this burden sharing does not occur, will the U.S. go it alone and provide the necessary food supplies, or you're going to all sit back and watch hundreds of thousands of people die? Thank you.
I assume you, I'm the Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and you wanted the Assistant Administrator.
So this is related in the food, you're related to the food shortages. Well, we have a bit of a problem in that how much food we provide is determined by our legislation. Last year, in 2004, we had resources to purchase. We had $1.2 billion to buy food, and that was a result of supplemental appropriations by Congress as well as our annual appropriations. We don't have those supplementary appropriations this year. Also, the price of food has gone up by 45% from 2001 to 2004. The cost of shipping food has gone up dramatically. It's just the economy is booming around the world and everybody's demanding ships, so we have to compete and buy those. Food prices are up in the United States, and according to our PL 480 or Public Law 480 legislation, we have cash, not food, but we are required to spend that cash and buy the food in the United States. With the food prices up in the U.S., we compete on the open market with others who purchase food. So demands for food by refugees and IDPs are going up. The amount of food dollars we have to spend is about half of what we had the year before. Food prices are up, transport prices are up, and we're just not going to be able to increase our food buying to meet those demands. It's a legislative requirement that we spend our money in the United States. So it's a little difficult for us to expand our food contributions. It would seem appropriate that other donors who have not should do that.
follow up. What about going to Congress for an emergency appropriation, temporary funding in event to avert a human catastrophe?
Well,
or is it going to be business as usual?
Well, obviously that's an option, and we have one short-term option, which is the Emerson Trust, where we can go to get food for unanticipated needs. But even that won't come close to meeting the billion-dollar deficit this year. The U.S. simply cannot do it with the variety of options available to it to meet the needs that are out there. We're going to have to count on the international community to come in and help out.
Richard, I apologize. Go ahead. Sorry.
It's a general question related to the food. Why is the demand for food going up at a time when the High Commissioner says the number of refugees is going down?
Well, there's a whole lot of market issues within the United States that I'm talking about specifically that have hurricanes and all sorts of things which have driven, have a lower food production, so the prices are higher. The number of internally displaced people is going up rather dramatically. Ethiopia is going up. Darfur continues to go up. There are food programs, problems in southern Africa. You've got Liberia, Congo, a lot of other places. You also have locusts all over the Sahel right now that are wiping out what everybody had hoped would be surplus production in Mali, Mauritania, Senegal, that area. Those are being wiped out by the day as locusts eat that stuff. So all around the world, the food requirements are going up, food availabilities are going down.
If I could, keep in mind, too, that while the overall refugee population decreased by 17%, that as refugees go back to Liberia, for example, it's very important that they have food to go back to. They have to be supported for a time, so you don't cut off their food supply from Sierra Leone or wherever they were seeking refuge. When they come back to Liberia, you have to continue that, and the whole repatriation solution in Liberia is at risk because of this worldwide food shortage.
Answer. I'll be quick. I've read some really disturbing articles about asylum seekers in the United States who, because of homeland security and the terrorist fear, are just being summarily locked up in detention centers and left to languish in rather difficult, sometimes really more than difficult, conditions for a rather long period of time. An example of a Buddhist nun who is a vegetarian comes to mind, a young woman. Hardly a threat, I would think. What is being done about that? Surely you must be aware of it. And is somebody in the United States actually looking into this? Because it seems like a wrong which needs to be righted.
The asylum seekers in the United States are dealt with by the Department of Homeland Security, so we're not directly involved with that situation. I'm not aware of this particular case with the Buddhist nun. If you have particulars on that, we'd be happy to follow up. Be happy to follow up on that, and I'm sure that if there's an appearance of injustice, this is something that ought to be brought to the attention of the Department of Homeland Security. We'd be happy to help on that if there is information which is not being dealt with in the U.S.
Yeah, Mr. Dewey. You mentioned in your speech that you're supporting the proposal for an Assistant Commissioner for Protection and also Special Advisor for the High Commissioner for Gender Issues. I'd like your views on the fact that UNHCR's Inspector General found three staff members of gross negligence during their management of refugee camps in Nepal, where 18 children as young as 5 were raped. Subsequently, these three officers were cleared of any wrongdoing, but UNHCR refuses to make available the transcript of how these people were cleared. I was wondering if you have any views on the lack of transparency by UNHCR, and also their code of behavior says the code does not have the force of law. Thank you.
We continue to ask the High Commissioner the same questions. We have to have accountability. As the major donor for UNHCR, we have a right to have accountability for the behavior of staff persons. This is part of my regular list of questions and consultations with the High Commissioner. Almost once a week we're on the phone talking about measures like this. So I assure you, this one is not forgotten.
Thank you very much.